Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Tonight, the show title is Tracking Down the Bad Guys, a conversation with retired U.S. Marshal and novelist Mark Cameron. Mark has about a three-decade history in law enforcement that began down in Texas, and he ultimately ended up as a chief deputy with the U.S. Marshal Service for a number of years. He also has a second-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu and teaches self-defense tactics for law enforcement agencies and civilian groups. He's also a writer, and he's written numerous short stories that have appeared in magazines such as Boy's Life, I grew up reading that, and Saturday Evening Post, grew up reading that too. He's also published a number of novels, 11 to be exact, and six of them in the Jericho Quinn thriller series, and we'll talk more about that later. And interestingly, he now lives in Alaska, and it's snowing there, I understand, as it always does. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Welcome.
For having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's great to be talking to you, Mark. So let's start out by just asking you, since you've had such a long and varied career, tell us what led to you to work in law enforcement in the first place.
Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing, but really, I think watching Batman shows when I was young, I always have kind of been the kind of guy that wanted to take up for the underdog and being interested in the Hardy Boys and, you know, Batman comics and things like that. And I was a big reader when I was quite young and read just about every Hardy Boys book there was and all the Batman comics and watched the shows. And as I got older, I realized there were actually jobs out there where you could wear a uniform and help put the bad guys in jail. So it just worked naturally, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm assuming that by then it wasn't a letdown that you wouldn't have the cape or the Batmobile or...
Yeah, you know, when I started, we didn't even have a ballistic vest. Bulletproof vests weren't even issued to us. And I had told my wife before we were married that I wanted to be a writer and teach school. And then I kind of sprung it on her right before the wedding that I still wanted to be a writer, but I told her I wanted to write, I wanted to be in law enforcement. And kind of the sweet girl that she is, she bought me an electric typewriter and a bulletproof vest the first year of our marriage. So, really good support right from the get-go.
That's a keeper, yeah.
That is.
So you began your career in small town Texas. And what was that like, and what was your rank, and what duties did you perform there?
Yeah, you know, I started off in the town that I went to high school in, a little town called Weatherford, Texas, right outside of Fort Worth. It was a small department that didn't pay very much to start out with. I think I made like $6 and, well, I know exactly how much I made. I made $6.67 an hour when I started work in 1984. When our first son was born, we were like $25 a year over the poverty line or something. It was crazy what kind of money we didn't make. Started off there. It was a good department, but it became a very professional department as the years went by, as far as the pay went up, the gear issue was better. It was a really good department to learn from and start in. I was fortunate enough to, you know, I could barely buy my own bullets when I started. I was 22 years old, really very green. I was fortunate enough to work patrol for a couple of years and be at the right place at the right time, and was assigned to investigations as a detective and worked everything from bicycle theft to homicides at the small. I think there was probably 25 sworn officers when I was there, so everybody was a little bit of a jack of all trades. So got sent to crime scene schools and eventually worked as an investigator, learned to be a law enforcement scuba diver while I was there, and finished off there before I got on with the Marshal Service. I volunteered for a mounted police unit and rode horses for about a year and a half. It was really a fun career. Like my partner and I on Mounted Patrol used to joke about having to walk in backwards to get our paycheck because we didn't want to look anybody in the eye and let them see how happy we were. It was good people. I still keep in touch with a lot of the people that I worked with at the police department. In fact, just spent some time with one down in Texas right now that's still with the Texas Bureau of or the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. Sorry about that clock in the background. still keep in touch with them. Good folks. In fact, I base quite a few of my characters off those early folks that I got to work with.
Well, any interesting cases from your time in Texas?
You know, all kinds. In fact, one of my first homicides that I ever investigated, I think I was about 26 years old, and so still very young in the ways of the world, and certainly young in the ways of working homicide cases. And a lot of people don't understand what Texas Rangers do. We watch Texas Rangers on TV and movies, but what Texas Rangers' job is actually to come in and assist young punk detectives like me. And so I got to be very good friends with a Texas Ranger in the area, and I remember vividly investigating a murder scene. And this was back before shows like Bones and things like that, where you saw a lot of that stuff on TV. So seeing decomposing bodies and things like that was kind of new for a young troop like me. And I remember being so nervous, taking my interviews, I mean, doing interviewing people at the scene. And I'd actually been assigned a missing persons case, and that's why I flowed over into the homicide case and it didn't go to a more senior detective, because I already had the basic information. And everybody, all the brass was out of town that weekend that the body was located. And so I was just nervous. I wanted to do a good, you know, service for the family. I wanted to make sure this was done right. And so I'd taken my measurements. There was a lot of other county people there and highway patrol and people kind of watching me, but I was the guy. And the Texas Rangers rolled up, and this Billy was his name, this ranger, and he came up to me, and he always chewed on a toothpick, and I'm standing by this body that's been decomposing in the Texas sun for several days, and I said, "Billy, tell me what I need to do here. I'm really nervous." And we squatted down by the body, and there's all kinds of larvae and stuff on it, and he started talking. He took out a little ranger notebook, and he said, "Well, Marcus, just write down everything you see." And Riley was talking, this fly hatched out of one of the larvae and flew into his mouth. And he just said, "Well, Marcus, just write down everything you see and watch out for the blowflies." And I really took that as advice for writing and being a detective and being aware, being hyper aware of the things that were around me. So I owe my time as an investigator, a tracker, and a writer to Billy, the Texas Ranger there out of Palapena County.
So pay attention and keep your mouth closed.
pay attention and keep your mouth closed. Yeah.
Well, after your stint in Texas with blowflies in about 1991, you were hired by the U.S. Marshals Service. And how did that transition come about? What led you in that direction, and how did that actually happen?
Well, you know, Hemingway has a quote, "There is no hunting like the hunting of men, and those that have," and I'm going to paraphrase it here, "but those that have hunted men long enough and enjoyed it never enjoy anything else thereafter." And once you hunt fugitives, once you kind of get that in your blood, then it's hard to want to go back and do some of the other things that I had done. And not to demean, I had a great time working traffic and, you know, investigating burglaries and all that stuff. But once you hunt fugitives, for me anyway, once I had a taste of that as a detective, working with the FBI, working with the U.S. Marshals, I really knew that's what I wanted to do. And kind of embarrassing story, I wanted to be a U.S. Marshal, really a deputy U.S. Marshal, when I was a kid in high school, because we had a town square in Texas, in Weatherford there, and there was parking meters all around the square. And I saw this big Dooley pickup drive up, and a tall guy with a gun that he wore outside his jacket, you know, with a badge beside it, a big hat. And he took a little bag out, and he put it over the parking meter, and it said, U.S. Marshals, official business. And I thought, I want to be that someday. Have one of those cool bags. And put it
away. I want one of those bags. I love them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I want one of those bags. But at that time, I was probably 15 years old. But as I grew up, in kind of an odd turn of events, that same deputy marshal in Fort Worth that worked Weatherford some, he's now the sheriff of Parker County, which is Weatherford's the county seat, and he was a senior deputy marshal that ended up doing my background investigation for the Marshal Service. So it was kind of right before he retired. It was kind of a cool little circle there. But so as I worked as a detective and got to work with him, I just saw what it was like and applied. And eventually, it took me about 2.5 years to get on, but I was eventually hired for the Eastern District of Texas, which the Marshal Service is set up along the lines of judicial districts. So Texas has 4 judicial districts. So I was assigned to the Eastern District up along the Oklahoma-Texas border in a little town called Sherman. So I worked there for several years.
I've actually been to Weatherford. It's a cute little town. It's very nice.
I didn't write you a ticket.
No. Somebody else was driving, thank goodness. Well, you know, some of our listeners may not even know exactly what the U.S. Marshals Service does. I mean, most people don't know that they even exist, but those that do not really know what they do. Everybody knows the CIA and the FBI and all that, but the U.S. Marshals Service is kind of one of these nebulous groups out there that we don't really know what their charge is, what their jurisdiction is, what kind of cases they get involved in. Can you tell us a little bit about exactly what the U.S. Marshals Service is all about?
Oh, you bet. I'm happy to. I love talking about the Marshals Service. The Marshals Service, we're not very good at tooting our own horn. We're a small agency, you know, probably less than 5,000 strong total across the nation and in various parts of the world. But it's the oldest federal law enforcement agency. George Washington started it in 1789, appointed a United States Marshal for each 13 states. But the Marshal Service was involved in the Whiskey Rebellion and the Boxer Rebellion. And then we have been around through all kinds of things in history. And one of the interesting things about the Marshal Service that drew me to it, where lots of other federal agencies have specific duties that are codified by U.S. Code, you know, 18 U.S. Code, whatever, and then it defines, you know, whether it's commerce or drugs or, you know, alcohol, tobacco, or whatever. They're codified by what they can do by statute. And since the Marshal Service was the first one, our code is to enforce federal law. So it's very, very broad, which means that the Attorney General can call on Deputy U.S. Marshals to be assigned after major hurricanes. I was assigned to the first response team after Hurricane Andrew in Florida back in the early 90s. They can send marshals to work after the Rodney King verdict, the riots. They sent 300 of us out there. I went and worked that. You know, major disasters, coal miner strikes in West Virginia, just anything where a federal law enforcement presence is deemed necessary, they can send in the marshals because our authority is very broad. On a day-to-day basis, the Marshal Service does the sexiest thing we do is fugitive apprehension. One of the major things we do is judicial protection. We protect any federal judge that has a threat. So we'll, you know, go up on a federal judge on put a detail, basically a protective detail, just as the Secret Service protects the president 24/7. The Marshal Service would protect the judge during the time of a bona fide threat or perceived threat that's articulable. So during the, for instance, the first World Trade Center bombing, when they were not quite successful in bringing Ramzi Youssef and his crew put a bomb under the World Trade Center and blew it up and did some damage, but they weren't able to bring them down at that time. And so the trial, he was arrested along with some others, and there was two big trials. So we had deputy marshals working the prisoner operation side and the judicial protection side, and I rotated through several times on the dignitary protection of the judges because of the crime, and we were just really understanding about that sort of terrorism, and so we had protective details on the judges. So fugitive apprehension, judicial protection, we also do, even though we kind of like it that people always attribute witness security, witness protection program to the FBI on TV, it's really the Marshal Service that does it. But that's not really something that we talk about at all because it's so sensitive and secret. We have a special operations group. It's like a SWAT team. We do civil and criminal seizures where we're like the, you could think of the Marshal Service as the escrow account for the government, where if the FBI or the Drug Enforcement Administration wants to seize someone's property along with a federal case, the Marshal Service actually does the seizing, administers that property. So we've had horse ranches and, you know, mansions and fancy cars and things like that. So it's a really varied job, and that's one of the things that was really appealing too. I've had times when I was going to be sent to a major trial, and by the time I was packed and ready to go, I'd be sent to some disaster at another part of the world or a witness security operation at somewhere else. And it's really varied, and that makes it enjoyable when you really don't know what you're going to be doing the next day.
Well, there's one U.S. Marshal that everybody knows, and that's Raylan Givens. Of course, that's the invention of the great Elmore Leonard, the late great Elmore Leonard, I might add, in his books and short stories, and, of course, the TV series Justified. And obviously, Raylan's known for being a wild card and you know, basically making up the rules as he goes. But how is that character like real life, and how does it vary from the job as you know it to be?
You know, that's a really good question. I think the kind of people that go into the Marshal Service are most generally, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of people that go into the Marshals are at least closet Raylan Givens type individuals. We want to we're justified in what we do, and you have to be the kind of person that works well kind of out away from the flagpole, so to speak. People that are in the military understand there's garrison soldiers and there's people that go out, and the Marshal Service is a real boots on the ground kind of an organization, and Raylan Givens is the kind of guy that he's not very good in garrison, and he's the kind of guy that you want to work with, but you never want to be his boss. Some of my favorite deputies that I worked with over the years, I would never have wanted to be their chief because I knew what they were like, and frankly, I'm not sure I'd wanted to be my own chief. That's kind
great
of what Raylan was like.
Yeah.
I would love to work with
him. Well, I grew up in I was born in Texas, so I know that locally that is referred to as a whole other country, but you ultimately ended up in Alaska, which is really sometimes like a whole other planet. So was that a difficult transition to go from a place like Texas where, you know, I remember those summers well, and to be someplace where really there are lots of different kinds of extremes, we'll put it that way. So how was that transition?
Yeah, you know, we had kind of a slow transition as my family. I always wanted to. From the time I was very young, I read a book called Two Against the North by Farley Mowat, and I just wanted to live in the North. And I mean, I carved a set of Eskimo snow goggles out of a cottonwood root from my backyard when we lived in Burleson, Texas. So I've just always wanted to live in the North, and perhaps it's the summers you talk about.
Yeah.
you just get tired of that humidity and heat. And I ended up marrying a girl from Canada, and so it was not hard to integrate her into Alaska. But we actually, I worked in the Marshal Service in Texas. Then I was assigned in North Idaho for 4 years up along the Canadian border. So we were, my kids got used to wintertime and snow and remoteness and that sort of thing, because I was in a two-person sub-office in North Idaho, where the main judicial district office was in Boise. So I was in Idaho, and then I ended up coming to Alaska kind of accidentally. The first time I was on a dignitary protection detail with the foreign minister of China, and it was during the Dayton Peace Accords, and so all the State Department people that I was working with had gone to Dayton for the peace accords to protect their people, and they asked for a volunteer to go with the foreign minister of China and the Secret Service detail that was with the premier of China at the time. They were traveling on the same aircraft, and they just needed a State Department person, which I was detailed to at the time, to be with the plane until it got out of American airspace. And so they landed in Anchorage to drop us all off, and it was in November, and my friend that was with the Marshal Service I'd worked with on several details, he picked me up, and we drove around, and there was moose walking down the road, and I always wanted to be here, but after I saw it, it kind of gets in your blood. And
it so, does.
Yeah, we. In fact, I started kind of having my little machinations to move up here and figure out ways, and politicking with the bosses. And I remember my friend called me and he told me there was going to be an opening. And my wife is a very spiritual person, so we were laying in bed and she was reading the Bible, I think, and I was reading my Cabela's catalog. And she heard me talking to my friend and on the phone. And when I hung up, she just looked at me and said, "We are not moving to Alaska." And about a month and a half later, we were in Alaska. So she. And she loved it.
Good.
It's a stunningly beautiful place.
Yes.
It's really unlike anything, isn't it? Well, speaking of unlike anything, did you run into different types of criminals and crimes in Alaska than you saw in Texas?
The criminals are pretty much criminals no matter where they are. But what's interesting about Alaska is that it's people that are in Alaska, many of them want to be off the grid. So some of the folks from North Idaho, say, share a lot in common with the folks up here, where they're out in the middle of perceived nowhere. The thing is, in Alaska, they can really get off the grid a little easier. We like to joke around when people come to visit that, welcome to Anchorage, you're only an hour away from Alaska. When you leave Anchorage, you can be, if you fly out in an airplane, any kind of aircraft, helicopter, or a fixed wing, you can be within an hour in a place where no one will ever find you. In fact, you can leave your car and start walking in some places north of Anchorage and no one will ever find you. So that makes it, I enjoy working rural with the man tracking stuff, and I'm a hunter and a fisherman and my kids are, and I like the water, I like boats. And so Alaska, because it's so huge, really lends itself to rural work, and so the people that we looked for up here, they really were kind of at the end of the rotors, so to speak, and that makes it very interesting for somebody that's trying to find fugitives.
I remember on a visit up there having someone talking about the famous ratio of men to women to warn women that yes, the odds are good, but the goods are odd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example. And my son is an Anchorage police officer, my youngest son, and he calls me because he wants to make me feel relevant, I think, still, since I'm retired, and kind of runs down his day for me. And he generally starts the telephone conversation like he'll going to be telling me something about his night. He works night shift, and he'll say, "Dad, people." And that's exactly right. They're just very unique. Very unique.
Yeah, that kind of sums it up.
Yeah, people. And up here, it's people with a capital P. It's a very, very
yes.
interesting places.
I've
gone in to arrest people, and one of my first arrests up here with that same friend of mine that kind of helped me move up here, we were looking for a guy out, really still on the roadway, but way back in the woods, and it was springtime, probably April, but still a lot of snow on the ground, but it's a beautiful time of the year because there's a lot of light by then, you know, it's already equinox time, and so a lot of snow with a lot of light, and we were kind of up in the mountains, and we had driven up and then hiked up to where this guy's cabin was supposed to be, and he had one of those Swedish sauna, or not saunas, but Swedish hot tubs, and he had had a little snorkel stove in it, so you start the fire, and the fire's actually down underwater, but there's a pipe that leads to it, and he and his wife had just, or girlfriend or somebody, had just thawed out that hot tub for the first time in a week or two, and, you know, thawed the ice out, and they were sitting in it naked, and so we knew they didn't have any guns, so we got him out. They were actually just stepping into the hot tub, and we ended up arresting him, and he was more bummed about not being able to sit out there after doing all that work in his hot tub.
That's funny. Well, what is it? You're a certified tracker, a man tracker, and what skills does that require, and what kind of techniques do you find the most useful to track down someone who just doesn't want to be found?
Sure, you know, tracking is it kind of circles back to the advice that Texas Ranger gave me about being observant. Trackers, a lot of times as a young officer even though I didn't know that I was tracking, when you're figuring out where somebody's footprints are going to be inside a building, say with a smash and grab, because a lot of people don't realize, of course, I guess they do now because everybody gets kind of a course in CSI from watching TV, but it's not just fingerprints. There's footprints and, actual imprints on linoleum from sneakers and all kinds of stuff like that. So as a young crime scene, detective that was having to work my own crime scenes, you're kind of looking at human behavior and being observant at that time anyway. And then when you actually get into the science and skill of man tracking, you realize you're not just looking for tracks, you're looking for what they call spoor in Africa, and we call it that as well, things that people leave behind, whether it's their own scat or urine or Band-Aids that fall off or things like that. I like to teach in sand or snow. A lot of the trackers that are teaching will build a sand trap where you can erase it and do different things. So it's not necessarily always about just finding the next track. It's really about being able to look at those tracks and tell the story. For instance, if you envision what your elbows do when you're laying on your belly, and what kind of a track your body would make with your elbows 2 points on the ground while you're looking through a pair of binoculars. If you think of what kind of imprint that would be. Now, if I came on that in the snow, I would see the print of a body with legs trail out behind it and 2 points where the elbows hit. Then I could say, okay, they're looking back at me. They're trying to observe me falling. But if I come up on that very same track and one of those elbows is further back and one is further forward, I can realize, oh, they got a rifle. They're setting up some sort of ambush for me. So looking at those little things that somebody might not necessarily be aware of. They say, oh, look, he laid down here. Little things like that. Little things like when people are getting hypothermic, the nerves on the front of their feet the nerves that run down the front of their shin don't work as well, so they start to clown walk. And so you can tell just by the roll of the foot in the track, whether it's snow or sand or whatever, if you get a good full track, you can tell, oh, they're slapping their feet, because you're learning to tell more than just finding the track. Finding someone's urine in the snow if it's getting darker and darker as you track them, then you realize they're becoming more and more dehydrated, which people that are pushed either by fear because they're lost or by law enforcement because they're running will sometimes become more dehydrated, and then they'll start to make poor decisions. So you take that into account. Something that I've used in my books in the past, men and women, when they go to the bathroom in the woods, you can kind of tell. It's not 100% sure, but a man in the woods is generally not that concerned, and he'll sit down and do his business in the woods, and it leaves a neat little pile. When a woman's in the woods, she's always scared of being caught and seen, and so they'll look over their shoulder several times during the act of going to the bathroom. So there's little crescent-shaped leavings there. Little things like that are kind of interesting to know about. You're really becoming a student of human nature, and that more than trackers that study. And it's a perishable skill. You have to do it all the time because your eyes really don't pick up a lot of the telltale signs unless you're really looking for them. My son's already talked about, he's been with the police department for a year now, and he's already talked about times that he's been able to figure things out just by some of the things that we've talked about as he's grown up tracking. So you can use it as a young patrol officer, or you can use it when you're out tracking bad guys into the woods. It's a pretty good skill to have.
That's amazing stuff. It never would have crossed my mind about those things. It makes so much sense, of course. It's like tracking a bear or a lion or a tiger, oh my. The creature has habits and the creature has things, yeah.
Do that. Yeah, absolutely. It might be a wounded bear, things like that. Or even another story that we see here quite often when we're out doing either training or just out, hiking in the woods, you'll find a human track with a bear track over the top of it. And that obviously tells you some kind of story right there, right? But if you find a human track with a bear track, superimposed over the top of it, which means the bear came later, and there's water flowing into that bear track from the surrounding area, then you can time the fact that, oh, that bear was that bear was just here a few minutes ago, So we pay pretty close attention to the wildlife around us up here.
I bet they
step out of the RV and into the food chain in Alaska.
So there's a possibility of finding the escapee in the scat of the bear.
yeah, exactly. And we always, whether it's fugitives or lost people, that's something that we're always concerned about is our own protection, and then also worried that we're going to come up on a bear scene. Fortunately, I never have. I've been fortunate that I haven't had to come up on something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the folks you helped track down was Farron Loveless. Can you tell us a little bit about him and what that case was all about?
Yeah, he was a very interesting guy. He was in North Idaho, and he had holed up on originally he was wanted for a parole violation federally. I believe his initial offense was armed robbery, and so we were looking for him, but he had, from the time we were looking for him, he kidnapped he's a white supremacist and anti-Semitic. He had kidnapped a Jewish couple over in Spokane, Washington, just across the border from where I was assigned in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And he had kidnapped a couple, held them at gunpoint in their own home for a couple of days and threatened them, and he was kind of moving up in the world, learning his craft, and he ended up not killing them. Stole some money, I think, and fled. And then he had holed up in the mountains, and we had different investigative methods and means that we were looking to find him, and some rural work, like I just talked about, with tracking and informants and things like that, and ended up locating him and actually luring him down off the mountainside because, you can imagine this would have been in, the late 90s or early, late 90s, I think 97, maybe 96. So it was right after Ruby Ridge, and you can imagine that the government was very tentative about launching any kind of campaign onto a mountain hideout in North Idaho. And we worked, the FBI and I worked together, and my partner happened to be out of town on the day of the takedown, so it was me and some bureau agents and county deputies from the northern counties there, the two northern counties in Idaho. And we ended up using a ruse to lure this guy down off the mountain, to lure Farron down off the mountain. He was so prejudiced that we basically told him there was a arms dealer, a Hispanic arms dealer that had some women with him, and he wanted to buy some guns. And we lured him down by saying that by having our guy tell him we're going to sell him some guns and we'll kill him and take his money and his women. And so he came down, and he came down on the off the mountain on a bicycle, and he had bear spray and duct tape and a gun in his back pocket and a rifle in his folding rifle in his backpack. And we ended up pinching him between myself and an FBI agent's car on the highway near Priest River, Idaho. And he fell off his bike. We tackled him, and it was a county deputy. I can't remember if it was Boundary County or Bonner County, but one of the two county deputies and myself tackled him as he was bringing the gun up, knocked the gun out of his hands, wrestled him to the ground, and the other deputy, in fact, it's kind of an interesting coincidence, a nurse happened to be driving by, and she thought he was sick and in an accident, so she came over, and we had to, with all the guns in play, we had to kind of push her out of the way to keep her from getting hurt, because she wanted to help out, you know, this poor injured guy that we were on the top of. But eventually we got the handcuffs on him. He fought us pretty hard, and we got the handcuffs on him. And I'll never forget standing him up. And I was kind of off to the side of him, and the county deputy stood him up. So Farron and I were face to face, and he had grass all on his face from hitting the ground, and he looked at me and he said, "It is obvious to me that you are more racially pure than I am, or you never would have won this. I never would have been arrested." So we
consistent to the end.
In the car. Say that again?
Consistent to the end.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So in the end, he was kind of one of those people that, you know, wants to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. He wanted to be in the limelight, and so he confessed on the way to the jail that he knew where a body was buried that he had killed. And you know, we kind of built up a little rapport there. We actually went up to his mountain hideout and hiked up and found all kinds of booby traps and fish hooks hanging from, you know, at eye level in the trees, and little makeshift landmines that he had used with shotgun shells and split, you know, stuff he'd read about in the Poor Man James Bond and the Anarchist Cookbook and things like that. So we were fortunate that we were able to defuse all the stuff and not take him there, because that would have been a really dangerous place. But he confessed, showed us the body, and we ended up spending quite a bit of time just looking for a tooth that he had knocked out of the guy's mouth before he killed him, and, you know, sifting through gravel and pretty tedious stuff, and ended up finding the tooth. And he was originally eventually convicted of homicide, and it took the jury about 15 minutes to find him guilty. It was not not very long. In fact, I don't think they even got to eat lunch. It was kind of a slam dunk case. And he was eventually sentenced to death, but then that was commuted to life when Idaho changed some of their laws, and so now he's serving a life sentence for murder. But interesting guy, and you know that I draw for, you know, a writer that gets the opportunity, if you can call it opportunity, to sit down with somebody that evil, that really lends itself to writing about bad guys. So.
Fascinating stuff. Any other interesting cases that you got involved in while you were up there in the frozen north?
Oh, my goodness. There's been all kinds of interesting cases. You know, what is what was interesting to me as a young man reading about, you know, arch villains and evil geniuses and things like that is that really most criminals, I've had 29 years in law enforcement before I retired, and I could count on both hands the truly, just two hands, the truly evil people that I've met. There's been people, you know, hundreds of people that I've arrested that have made really bad decisions and done evil things, but I don't, you know, not just offhand, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe a dozen, maybe 10. I don't think over 10 really evil people, but Farron was one of those people, Farron Loveless.
Oh, yeah.
There's been, you know, several. We had a guy in Texas when I was a pretty young deputy, still in my early 30s, that raped his ex-wife in front of their kid and kidnapped her and drove her across state lines, which made it a federal crime. And we ended up arresting him. And he was, we were taking him to jail, taking him to prison after he was convicted. And I mean, he was just the kind of guy that would, you just knew that you were going to have to shoot him. He would do hundreds of push-ups and hundreds of sit-ups every day. And, you know, he kind of knew from us what we had planned for him if he didn't cooperate, and we knew from him that he was just a bad guy. And we stopped to get gas one time, and he didn't think the air conditioning was up high enough, and so he just broke the window out with his head so he'd get some air. And then, you know, when we looked at him, he was like, yeah, it was hot back here. So, you know, you look somebody like that in the eye for very long, and it's easy to come up with a bad guy character. So he definitely falls. I don't want to say his name because I think he's actually still under appeal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
There's some really wicked folks. But, you know, even not the evil, wicked folks, I knew, as I said, I knew I wanted to write. And so it was kind of crime writing 101. And as a deputy, you have a deputy marshal. Nowadays, a lot of people are moved by aircraft. But when I first started in 91 and on for several years, we were in sedans. And it would be two deputies and two or three prisoners in the back of a Crown Victoria with a cage in it, or, you know, at the most, a van. And so I remember arresting a guy who was really a white-collar guy. He had been in prison and done his time, got out on parole. Now, parole's been abolished now, but the people that were still on parole were kind of grandfathered in, if you will. They were still on parole. And so when you arrested them, from a deputy's point of view, it was a good arrest or an easy arrest because you didn't have to go back to court. They went straight to jail. You arrested a parole violator, they went back to prison. There was no waiting around for a hearing or anything like that. The hearing took place beforehand. And we arrested this guy, as was our custom, early, early in the morning, like 4 o'clock in the morning. And he had violated parole by, I think, getting a DUI or something like that. And so he was going back. He had to go back and do the rest of his 18 more months because of that. And but a super nice guy. One of the only times I've ever let a prisoner, you know, an arrestee, hug and his wife goodbye or kiss his baby, because you never know what they're going to do if they get a baby in their hands. But he was just, you could just tell he was just a guy that had made some bad choices. And so, but kind of a heavy set guy. We put him in the back of the car, and we had to drive to Siegelville from Plano, wherever we were, north of Dallas. And so we were driving to Siegelville prison, and he was chatting with us about what it was like in prison. And the closer we got to prison, the more his eyes started to look crazy. He started to kind of swell up in back. And I was driving, and I kept glancing in the rearview mirror, and he just turned into a different person. I mean, just every mile we got closer, he got tougher and meaner and harder looking, to the point that his countenance just really changed. And I said, are you all right? And he kind of looked at me, kind of reverted for a second back to that nice guy we arrested. And he said, yeah, I just got to put on my prison face. Just got to put on my prison face, or I just won't survive in there. It's just a real telling, really telling moment for me. So, yeah, I use stuff like that in the books as well.
So you've worked coast to coast, and I'm sure as the ground changes, the tracking has to change. Is that true? Is it different region to region?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And as I said, as a tracker, it's not just about the feet on the ground, but it is that as well. So there's a lot more urban work in other cities, and so when you're looking for, say, we're on the Marshal Service does what they used to call them FIST operations, Fugitive Investigative Strike Teams. They call them something else now, Falcons, I think, and I can't remember what that acronym stands for, but it has to do with state and locals and federal agencies working together. But they'll basically send detailed teams of deputy marshals to work in a given area and saturate that area for fugitive apprehension. And they'll assign you with a state or local investigator and turn you loose with a stack of warrants. And so I worked one down along the Texas-Mexican border, and there you have. And we actually did use quite a bit of boots on the ground trying to kind of tracking in, because we were out in a lot of ranches. And so sometimes the tracking could just be to tell what kind of numbers you're dealing with when you're walking up. Any law enforcement officer who's ever gone up to arrest somebody knows to look for piles of dog poop in the front yard. And, even though that's not a tracking skill per se, it's an observation skill, so you know what you're dealing with. So urban tracking is more about looking, feeling the hood of the car when you walk up to see if it's still hot, looking at kids' toys in the front yard. It's just really, tracking is all about observation. So the spore that's left behind and the tracks are just a minor part. But in Texas, Idaho, I've done some work in Nebraska. There's plenty of rural parts in the rural areas in the United States that, track by track work is still done, and oftentimes not long term like it is here, where a good buddy of mine, in fact, he took my place as the chief in Alaska. He's a tracker as well, and he tracked a guy across ice. So just looking for the telltale prints on this ice road where there were no vehicles able to get in, and was just able to never get a good set of prints, but just scuff marks and toe prints and heel marks and things. Tracked him for over a mile and a half and ended up making the largest off-grid marijuana arrest in the state's history, because he was, he was patient and took his time tracking. So you don't have that kind of thing down in places in the lower 48, but you're still, another thing that I learned as a tracker is it's not always the spore on the ground or even the vehicle. Sometimes it's just the people around. Imagine when someone, imagine a movie where a chase scene's going on. If the person runs through a crowd, there's a certain emotional vapor, if you will, that makes people all glance after that person that's running. You can come along, probably as late as a minute to 2 minutes later, and there's still a trail of folks wondering what's going on. And so being aware of the people around you. There's several times that I've been in foot pursuits where I've lost sight of the person that I've been running after, and you just look at the folks around you, and they tell you where they're gone just by their gaze. So that's tracking as well. So in an urban environment, you would use that a lot more than a rural environment.
So in Alaska, you're in a really different environment. So what makes tracking someone in that environment difficult?
There's so many factors. One thing that I should point out is that tracking is never done, I shouldn't say never, but rarely done alone. And in Alaska in particular, you not only have the bad guy or guys up ahead of you who may want to shoot back at you or leave, you know, counter tracking. Or, you know, I always giggle when if somebody tries to cover their tracks with a leaf. That, you know, with a branch, like, you know, the old Lone Ranger. That's like, thanks for that bigger track, dude. But so you don't have to. You only have to worry about the person that you're chasing, but you have to worry about the environment, because in Alaska, you may a friend of mine was on a track. I think it was last year or the year before, fell through some thin ice in a bog. You know, kind of going across a shallow, like a foot deep lake, boggy area next to, and fell through, and his tracking mission was over for the night because it was 22 below zero, and once you fall through, you can't go any further or you'll lose a foot. And so you really have to think about the environment. You have to be aware of avalanches here. You have to be aware of deep snow. So, you know, and we've all of it, I think every deputy that's moved to Alaska has been caught at some point in snow up to their thighs while the person they want to arrest either walks away or runs away on snowshoes, while you're cursing yourself because your snowshoes are in the back of your Suburban. thinking about that snow environment, the wet environment. So you have not only the bad guy, but you have Alaska that may try to kill you, and that's not even taking into account the bears and the moose. And I, like I said, fortunately, I've never had a bear run in on duty. I've had that same deputy friend of mine. We were out moose hunting, and we ran into a grizzly bear sow and some cubs. And so I've had my share of coming up against bears, but I have. In fact, we were on a barricaded subject my first month, maybe 2 months in Alaska, a barricaded subject that was wanted, and he barricaded himself in the house. Anchorage police came, their SWAT team came, and we were already so close to the house that we really couldn't back off without being in the line of fire. And so we were basically just pressed up against the outside of this, you know, urban, you know, houses all around us area, and but still Alaska, so there's lots of green belts nearby. And there was kind of a little privacy fence around on the back that I had fairly good concealment, not a very good cover at the time if the guy started shooting. So I was hunkered down so I wasn't seen. And there was the APD SWAT guys got there, and they had, I just had my pistol, and they had MP5s and, you know, bigger weapons. So they were taking up positions by that privacy fence. And so I was between the fence and the house, and a SWAT guy came around the corner, and I heard him go, like that, and I thought, oh my gosh, the guy's coming out. And I looked up, and there was a cow moose and a calf running between the house and the privacy fence, and we just flattened ourselves up against the house, and she thankfully ran past us. And we've had several issues with moose like that, and frankly, I'm much more terrified of a mama.
Oh yeah, they're aggressive.
Baby than I am a bear in the urban environment.
Well, and they're just so much more huge.
Yeah.
Then you can imagine them being until you're within sight of one. I don't think you realize, you know, no nature film can represent you how just how, and they're fast.
And they're bigger than your car. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and they can kick forward, and yeah, it's crazy.
Well, Mark, the time here has just flown. I mean, we got a gazillion other things we want to talk about. And we got about 5 more minutes, and I really want to talk about your fiction, and I want to talk a little bit about that, your writing, and particularly your protagonist, Jericho Quinn. Can you tell us about your books and about him and how he's like you and how he's not like you?
Oh, I'd love to. I started off writing westerns and kind of literary stuff, but I've always been the kind of guy who liked to live a life that was maybe prone to broken ribs, and I ride motorcycles and like to ride horses. I like boats and I like fast cars. And in kind of deciding about a kick butt kind of character, my boys are now both in law enforcement. My son's an Air Force Academy grad, and so I started, and I've always thought that foreign languages were important too, and so my eldest son speaks Mandarin, and my youngest took Japanese in school. I speak Japanese somewhat, not very good, but I used to. And so I just developed this character that rode motorcycles. He's an Air Force Academy grad, an OSI agent with the Air Force, which, kind of like the Marshal Service, nobody knows what OSI does, Office of Special Investigations. There, everybody knows what NCIS does because they have a TV show. OSI actually turned down that opportunity, thinking it wouldn't go anywhere, dang them. So my main character is an Air Force OSI agent. The secondary character is the kind of a Marine gunnery sergeant. I've got lots of Marines that worked with me in the Marshal Service, so I have a special kinship with them. But he rides a BMW motorcycle, a BMW GS, which is kind of an off-road, on-road motorcycle, which is what I ride, and gets to wear a leather jacket and where he can hide his guns and knives and basically go out and do the kind of things that those of us that have worked in alphabet acronymed agencies wish we could do all the time, but we're kind of hobbled by rules and red tape. And I think my youngest son, when he read the second book, he was in his late teens at the time, and he really summed up what the Jericho Quinn books are about when he called me and he said, and a Royal Enfield, by the way, is a kind of a motorcycle. And he called me and he said, "Dad, I hope that someday I can wheelie a Royal Enfield into oncoming gunfire and save the girl." That is, I like to say, because I went to so many Joint Terrorism Task Force meetings and, you know, had a top secret clearance when I retired, I'm very careful that I don't write a Clancy-esque kind of book, and I love Clancy books, but I want my books to be possible, highly possible, but not probable. So my books are a little bit over the top. They're fun. A lot of motorcycle chases, a lot of blade work, a lot of shootouts. But my guy gets hurt. Jericho, as you read the books, he loses piece of himself along the way, toes and earlobes, and because you can't live the James Bondian kind of life and come out unscathed. And so I try to be realistic. When I talk about something, it's certainly possible technically and that sort of thing, but I like books that are escapist books that are just, well, I have to write in silence. I can't have music playing and things like that. I like the fire going. I like my, you know, I call it cowboy TV. I keep the cowboy TV playing while I'm writing, but I can't have music playing outside of me. But if I don't hear the Indiana Jones theme playing in my head, then I'm probably not on the right track when I write. I like that.
I like that.
Going on all the time.
Well, I tell you what, this has been more than fascinating. It's been outstanding, yeah. And I wish we had more time. And as our listeners know, on the websites, the various websites, my website, Jan's, the Crime and Science Radio website, we will have links to your website and your books and some other articles and things and for further study. And, Mark, it's just been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and it's been so informative.
Oh,
thank you
fun.
So much.
Absolutely. And really, really, I know our listeners are going to love not only this program, but really looking forward to learning more about Jericho. So, it's
thank
been
you
great.
So much. I really appreciate the opportunity. This has been great fun.
Well, we've enjoyed it. Until next time.